Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Now on BBC World Service, an unspeakable act. Will Storr examines rape as a weapon of war.
Ile makati nikisani kwa mwezi wa 12 ilikuwa 11:05 kuna weli malia na weli ilikuwa gasiku ya
nikake umva mubire kule winja lero urenera kwa mangonja nyumba mwa mwezi kwa kishana kisha
kidogo mimi napiga usiku 2 ilikuwa sikia ile
ilikuwa gaisi kwa usiku
My name is Marie Claire. I was raped on the morning of February the 4th.
Mama Salome is a bit physically thin, but she's really so big in heart. She works with Christian Aid. Christian Aid is the group with which we are working together in the matter of gender-based violence, but we are working in Shabunda and Mwenga territories.
So hello, everybody. My name is Will, and I've travelled from the UK. And I'd just like to thank you for taking time out of your Sunday to spend some time with us. And thank you also for your courage in telling us your stories. So thank you.
Asante-san.
During the war period, the conflict period, we really experienced very, very bad things, especially the rape.
Before anything else, what gets you about the Democratic Republic of Congo is the numbers. They speak of the wealth of the place, untapped mineral resources worth an estimated $24 trillion. They speak of its size. They speak of its natural beauty. 50% of the African continent's forest is here. They speak of its possibilities. One UN report said that the DRC could generate enough hydroelectric energy to power all of Africa. But the numbers speak too of injustice and horror. The 6 million that have been killed since 1996, the 45,000 people that are still killed every month, the 50% of the population who, as is said, perished during Belgian occupation, the 700 to 800 killings that 19th century explorer Sir Henry Morton Stanley boasted of having been personally instrumental in. It was Stanley that wrote to the Congolese, "The savage only respects force, power, boldness and decision," and was to inspire Joseph Conrad to famously christen this place the Heart of Darkness. But there is a darkness here that is spoken of less frequently than plunder and murder. A 2010 survey found that 22% of men and 30% of women have had sexual violence used against them as a weapon of war. The Democratic Republic of Congo is the rape capital of the world.
I was raped on the morning of February the 4th. I was at my house in the village with my husband and 6 children when the Intrahamwe attacked and broke into our house. They took me and my family to a place I did not know, somewhere in the forest. They took many families. They raped me and killed my husband and 6 children.
How many men raped you?
There were 4 men. 4 Hutus.
And whilst these men were doing this to you, how were they behaving? Were they shouting? Were they singing, laughing?
They were laughing, having fun. One was entering me, and then another, then another. It was like a joke to them. I can't remember more because as I was being raped, there was so much pain. It was like a nightmare. Like I was unconscious and I couldn't look at my children and husband anymore.
And can you describe how they beat you? How did you receive these wounds?
I had many wounds all over my body, especially between my legs. I remember they hit me as I fought them. My genitalia, even now, is very bad, and when I go to urinate, it feels like I'm falling apart. I am living with much fear. I don't want to remember, but what was terrible for me was that my husband was the only man I had known, and I was taken by another man. It is not easy to forgive or to forget.
How were your husband and children killed?
I did not see how they killed my husband and children. They raped me and the other women near a well in the forest. After raping me, they sent me back to the village but kept my husband and children. After a month, I was still waiting for them to return, and I saw pictures of my husband and children and so many others. Even a doctor of our community was killed, and I knew then my family was no longer alive. My six were killed with my husband.
You say you saw photographs that pictured your husband and children. Can you describe what was in the photographs?
The
pictures were brought to me whilst I was in hospital. I remember it was some organization who were trying to find out what happened. They were showing those pictures to people to see if they could recognize their relatives. I saw my husband and children in the photographs, and they had been killed with a knife. Their hearts had been cut out, but I could see their faces. I fainted. The organization stopped showing the pictures because so many people were so badly affected by them. My head always hurts. It never stops because of so many thoughts. And as I remember now, it feels like my mind is falling apart. And I can say in our community, so many households and marriages are breaking down because so many are being raped.
The women that we spoke to that morning were exceptionally brave. Rape is such a profound taboo that most in this region fear to speak of it. But it's far from being just a Congolese problem. Modern academics point to evidence of wartime sexual violence all over the world, from Sri Lanka to Bosnia to Abu Ghraib prison. What is not widely known is why. What is its purpose as a weapon? What is its uniquely devastating power? These stories are so profoundly disturbing that it is easy to find yourself reaching for the simple and emotional reasons to explain them. These perpetrators are evil and depraved, you think. They are monsters. But behind these apparently senseless acts, there often lies tactical sense. Lara Stempel is an academic at the University of California's Health and Human Rights Project.
Sexual violence in armed conflict is an incredibly successful tactic because it humiliates, shames, and traumatizes the victims.
You can see that in its impact, it's as effective as all sorts of other kinds of weapons.
Dr. Chris Dolan is director of the Refugee Law Project in Kampala, Uganda.
In fact, in terms of creating disharmony and breaking up the social fabric, it's more effective than many other weapons. Every single relationship in that household and with the neighbours and with the broader community is affected by one rape and one child born out of that rape. Then you see you know, the magnitude of it as a weapon of war.
We can surmise that in a state of armed conflict where violence is everywhere, rape is very often an expression of total domination and complete subjugation. So in some sense, it is the ultimate weapon.
And it's extremely damaging psychologically. Often people describe to me that the sexual violence has been much worse than any form of physical violence.
Dr. William Hopkins is a psychiatrist at the Freedom from Torture organisation.
People term it internal torture, in a way. People can deal with something they can see, a burnt hand or a removed finger. But the thing about sexual torture is that, actually, as well as the perpetrator harming the person harms themselves because they hate themselves. And it also seems to be, in a sense, an act of total domination, and that they can do anything to these people. That reminds me of a case of a woman who'd been raped who became pregnant while in detention, and they gave her an abortion without an anaesthetic. And they said, look what we can do. We can even get inside your body and remove parts of you. Think what we can do. There's nowhere that you're safe from us.
Sexual violence is a broad definition and comprises far more than straightforward male penetration. Dr. Dennis Mukwege is a gynaecologist at Panzi Hospital in Bukavu, DRC.
I can say that most of those cases are followed by the destruction of the vagina. So after raping, they also abuse with the woman by using an object, for example.
Je pense que je vais aller étape par étape.
I will go stage by stage. We have received cases of women who have been raped, and after being raped, they also used the gun. They used the gun to abuse.
First, the genital.
We also have cases of those who were raped, and they also used the knife. After raping, they used the knife that destroys almost everything in the vagina.
Nous avons eu des cas où,
we also had cases of those who were raped. Then they used, they burned plastic. Okay, they take a plastic, they burn it, they make fire. Then they start, they leave that plastic pouring on the vagina of the woman.
It is shocking when you hear these stories that more is not being done. There is little apparent concern from the international community about the barbarism at play in the Congo. Of course, for there to be hundreds of thousands of victims of rape, you need many thousands of perpetrators. It is one of the hardest things to understand. What drives these men? How do they become so brutalised?
I think that's part of military training. In a way, it's trying to take away the individual. And all the training is about being a collective, doing something together, not caring about sort of more gentle sensitivities, trying to make them brutal. And also not act as an individual, because in a way that's how you can, if you're an individual, you might actually feel morally responsible, where if you're acting as a group, then in a sense you feel, oh, it's all right to do these things, it's not my responsibility, it's the commander telling us to do it, it's the platoon doing these sort of things.
When you put it like that, it makes it feel inevitable that these things are going to happen in a war situation.
Not always, because you can have some armies or some divisions where they don't do these things, in the sense they have high standards, and then it doesn't occur. And then you'll have other armies which have poor leadership or poor morals, where it does happen.
The Congolese army, who are supposed to protect their population, are frequently accused of perpetrating sexual violence themselves. I met one group of officers who have been tasked with reducing human rights abuses by the military.
Ici, à ma droite, c'est Major Bassima.
On my right, we have Major Bassima, and he's our focal point in the program of military protection in the army, the local army.
Dans le cadre précis, on va vous présenter.
We'll just present to you the protection program, and it aims at protecting the vulnerable women.
Your presentation was very interesting and contained many encouraging signs. It is a priority for you to eradicate the problem of sexual violence within the army. Is it a priority for all of the seniority of the DRC army?
It is our first priority. The awareness we are trying to instill in soldiers in relation to sexual violence is utmost importance, because our society is failing, and I believe we have to show the inhumane nature of what is happening here.
It is said that it is in the interest of various parties for there to be violent disorder in this region in order that minerals can be exploited. Is this true?
Exploiter les minerais, ça peut-être je ne peux pas le confirmer.
I really can't say if that is true or not. But we must understand, above all else, this is a cultural issue. Because the military had been encouraged in the past to believe that whatever you encounter is yours to take, even women. It has been ingrained in our culture for such a long time.
The ordinary soldier, his pay is low, him and his family live in quite humble conditions. Is it difficult to keep discipline over the soldiers when they are paid very little and sometimes not at all?
Philosophically speaking, my view is poverty encourages criminal behavior. And so it is the cause, or at least a major factor in the situation. That behavior has for a long time been habit. But in the training we are giving soldiers, we are trying to show that despite the pressures of financial duress and starvation, we must endure and stay calm and stay self-disciplined until our situation improves. Because without this awareness, without this training, we will achieve nothing.
But it seems they are not enduring. Recent reports tell of members deserting in high numbers in fear of advancing rebel troops. All this is deeply discouraging news for the population of this place, who continue to suffer the most horrific assaults.
The first time it happened was 7 years ago, the 25th of December, Christmas Day. It was the Inter-Ahamwe. It was in the night and we were all asleep. They broke down our door and took my husband and tied him to a tree within sight of me and the children, and they took me by force and raped me without shame. They raped me one by one. I fought back, but they beat me with the butt of a gun and knocked out my front teeth. They left our house and they moved on to our neighbours' houses. They broke into their houses and even killed some of them. They were killing them and cutting out their hearts and taking them and leaving the corpse. And sometimes, after removing the hearts, they would kill a baby and place the dead child's body where the heart should be. The next morning, my husband was still tied to the tree and was calling to me, get up, release me, why are you lying there? But I could not move because of my injuries. Our neighbours eventually came and freed him. They were saying, what happened, but we kept it a secret and did not tell them I was raped. Not even my children would say what had happened to their mother.
So can you take me through, step by step, the second incident?
The second time was in March. They were a different group and my husband was not there. They shouted, open, open, as they banged on the door. We had nothing left in the house for them, and so they were angrier. They asked for money and I gave them the little that I had, but they still raped me. My uncle came to help, but they killed him and his child, and they took out his heart and stuffed his son into the wound. They were so angry that we had nothing to give them, but after raping me, they took a plastic bag on the end of a gun and raped me with that. The pain was so great, and the plastic was inside me for many days. We walked for 3 days to the hospital. Parts of the bag are still inside me, and even now, my wounds are such that in the inside of my genitals, the womb will fall out. I am so sad. I am still a young woman, and I wanted more children.
It was at midnight, we came across two young girls. We found this as an opportunity. And I then caught a 10 years old, a young girl, and we made love. Unfortunately, as I was a mature guy, I happened to destroy this young girl. This is a practice that I didn't start today. And when a woman is crying for or help, then sometimes I continue without taking care of her cries. And if I find that she exaggerates, I can even beat her. And then at this time, she's going to understand that she has to keep quiet and leave me do my work. And if we are in a group of people, 5 to 12, she will wait until all the 12 people have finished, and then it's the time she has to keep quiet since there is no reason to cry.
How do you feel after you have raped somebody?
After raping, I feel very happy. I feel very happy. And if we are in a group of people, someone else comes to do the action, he leaves another one, and so on. We feel happy.
My dream about the future is simply to have peace. Peace in the Congo and peace for my family and to see them grow up. I no longer want to hear the radio because I hear news of how other women are being raped. I pray for the women in the forest. I pray for God to help them to survive like I have survived.
Her prayers have not been answered. At the beginning of July, rebel troops, led by a renegade army general who is wanted by the International Criminal Court, took a series of key towns in the east of the country. They are currently 40 kilometres north of Goma and fighting their way ever further towards the Lake Kivu region. The DRC is in the midst of its worst crisis in years. Over the coming weeks, the news might tell us the big stories about diplomatic messages of concern from international governments and the movements of armies. What we won't hear are testimonies like we've heard in this programme. New narratives of horror, just like these, are being written today and will continue to be written over the coming weeks as the violence increases. For me, these small stories are the most important of all. They are what make the big ones matter. During my visit, I was most humbled by the importance that these women attached to our bearing witness. No matter how depraved were the words that they recounted, they spoke them without fear or shame. What they wanted was for us to make a record of their experiences so that you would eventually hear them. It was your listening that they wanted, that you and the rest of the world should know what has happened to them and what is still happening today.
That was a Tinderbox production for BBC World Service.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.